for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention, a kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene. That stage is here, amongst the untamed breadth of the World Wide Web. The princes are we, bearded bastards from distant lands. And that, of course, leaves the monarchs to reside amongst you all, for any man wise enough to throw his lot in would they came from the north, the every other fortnight measure of film-going wisdom, flavored with the unmistakable essence of maple, bacon, and beer, is truly a king among men. Tonight we turn our attentions to the directing career of a man once heralded as the new Olivier, known for his stylish adaptations of the works of William Shakespeare and his camera-tilting Dutch angles. We are, of course, talking about the Belfast barnstormer himself. Gentlemen online now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whilst any speaks that fought with us amongst the bloody breach of the film career of Kenneth Branagh.
Did you just say something about holding your manhood?
I'm holding your manhood right now.
No, you're not.
That was spectacular.
That was absolutely phenomenal.
Yes.
I have two erections.
Well played, Mr. Mercer. Well played.
Thank you. You can introduce ourselves, because I'm not doing it.
What?
Forsooth. Verily.
I forgot to write an introduction.
Come on.
Just say something in Brian Blessed's voice.
No.
Spunk bubble!
The Dauphin does not approve.
I just need to bring up the Wikipedia page. Here we go. I'm your host for the night, John Mercer. Representing once the French Quarter of Canada, now a turncoat living amongst the enemy, Mr. Gabriel Girard.
Bonjour, I guess.
He laughs at his betrayal.
I laugh at your outrage.
Further south, in that land of sin, representing the city of Dis, we have Clark Province.
Hi.
Provence.
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 Just call him Julep.
Yeah. No.
Julep the Julep.
Clark, can I call you Colonel?
Why not?
I'm sure you can come up with at least two reasons.
I don't care what you call me, so long as you call me.
Excellent.
And for the first time ever tonight, we've got more than two of us in the same room.
A terrifying prospect.
Yes.
Truly frightening indeed.
As you just heard, sitting to my immediate right, representing the rest of Newfoundland outside of God's country, Seal Cove. And for some godforsaken reason, Andrew Forbes came to this miserable rock floating in the North Atlantic.
I concur.
He asked for a tourist attraction. We told him about the pharmacy.
And it's made the whole trip go smoother.
It's certainly eased the anxiety a little, hasn't it?
Moving on. Sir Kenneth Charles Branagh was born 10th of December, 1960.
But he's a knight?
Yes, he's a knight.
Wow. Don't give that to anybody these days.
Was born and raised in Belfast, Northern Ireland, the son of working-class Protestant parents. At the age of nine, relocated with his family. How are you born and raised if you relocated at the age of nine? You're not done being raised at nine.
No, not really.
Partially, Kenneth Branagh was.
It's hard out there, man. Northern Ireland. Right out there for a pin. At the age of nine, he relocated with his family to Reading, Berkshire, to escape the Troubles. He was educated at... I'm not reading all that. Educated at Grove Primary School.
Basically, he turned English.
Yes.
Well, I see how it is. Rather than join the struggle with his fellow Irishmen, he went traitor and...
And studied...
Well, in fairness, he was a Protestant Northern Irish guy, so he would have been loyal to the UK. Yes. That is me agreeing to have more beer.
He's got the worst Wikipedia page I've ever seen. It's so detailed. I need bullet points, goddammit.
Is there anything there about his death?
It is like the script to Hamlet.
Anyway, continue.
Okay.
We were talking about stuff.
Branagh achieved some early measure of success in his native Northern Ireland for his role as the title character in the BBC's Play for Today, known as the Billy Plays, from 1982 to 1984.
His name was Billy?
Probably. Received acclaim in the UK for his stage performances. Let's move on to his film work.
Mm.
Blah, 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 blah.
blah, blah, full of himself, thinks he's Olivier.
He's, best known for his film adaptations of William Shakespeare, beginning in 1989 with the superb Henry V, followed in 1993 by Much Ado About Nothing, Hamlet in 1996, Love's Labour's Lost, in 2000, and As You Like It in 2006. His notable non-Shakespeare films include Dead Again in 1991, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in 1994.
And Thor.
Yeah.
Although that's basically a Shakespeare play.
I'm getting to that, Gabriel. I'm getting to that. This Wikipedia page is terrible. I really should have prepared more for this.
You did that really bitchin' intro, man. That earned you points.
Yeah, no, I had to go to work today, and I didn't think I was going to.
Meandering son of a bitch.
Also, he was in full armor.
His family name is actually Brethnock. My God, he does sound like a Welshman. Brethnock.
Brethnock.
Brethnock!
It sounds like a name someone would shout before clefting someone else in twain, doesn't it?
Brathnot.
Okay, sorry, I have a list here. Henry V in 1989, Dead Again in 1991, Swan Song in 1992, Peter's Friends in 1992, Much Ado About Nothing in 93, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein in 94, In the Bleak Midwinter in 95, Hamlet in 96, Love's Labour's Lost in 2000, Listening in 2003, The Magic Flute in 2006, As You Like It in 2009, They Skipped Sleuth in 2007, Thor in 2011, and 2014 he's done Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit, and I believe has an upcoming adaptation of Cinderella in 2015.
Hmm.
If Maleficent makes money.
If Maleficent. It already has, hasn't it?
Yeah, but it hasn't made crazy money. I think they were expecting Alice in Wonderland coin.
Hasn't made glass slipper money.
No.
So,
they're not drinking Merlot out of glass slippers at Disney.
Knowing that he's chosen the same good as me, I'm going to let Andrew start up.
Shit. Okay. Henry V is basically amazing. There are a lot of things... I mean, in some ways,
can you
I kind of wish.
The Benny will be first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For first time listeners on what
backtrack.
Is the worst.
For those of you who are first time listeners, where the fuck have you been for the last 40 odd episodes?
Good job on sticking with this episode this long.
My fancy, it's hot, and I've been drinking.
It's dreadful hot. Frightful hot.
Clark knows all about that.
Good or good, bad or flawed, ugly or shit.
Yeah.
There we go. There we go.
We named them after a Clint Eastwood movie. If you haven't seen that, why are you here?
Because that's how I roll.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving on.
All right. Well, I was about to say, in some ways, I kind of wish I could talk about bad first, because a lot of the reasons I think Henry V is his best movie is because he manages to avoid a lot of the problems he has in his other movies that come up a lot. But anyway, basically, it is... a fairly lean, really smart, beautifully shot adaptation. It has some of the best interpretation of Shakespeare dialogue that makes it completely accessible to modern viewers. It has Brian Blessed in the most badass scene that's ever been filmed.
Ultimatum.
Yes.
Yeah, amazing sequence.
And on top of that, something that I don't think gets enough appreciation about Henry V... is a really smart framing device with Derek Jacobi.
Oh my God, the opening chorus in that.
Yeah, Derek Jacobi is the chorus, and he's basically in modern dress, and it's treated as this really interesting fusion of a stage production and an incredibly cinematic adaptation that sounds awkward, but works just beautifully. And somehow Branagh manages to walk this really fine line of some pretty extreme tonal shifts, I mean, the movie goes from sort of bleak to scary to rousing to light humor. That's sort of the broad overall tonal journey, but I mean, within that, there are small little, modulations of that. And it's just like incredibly watchable.
What struck me initially the first time I ever spotted it was on the first time I saw it was on DVD.
Yeah.
And it was one of those movies that always popped up on a Walmart spinner rack.
It was an MGM.
You always saw it on those $14.99 Walmart spinnerama.
What do they call those? Oh, they're
budget racks, you know.
Or just like Shoppers Drug Mart.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, you know.
It always showed up.
They were everywhere. They were absolutely everywhere that sold DVDs in 1999.
Yeah, what do they call that when a studio just dumps a
catalog title. Yeah. And the cover always struck me as looking badass as all hell. And I sat down and I watched the movie, and I mean, I knew it was Shakespeare, and I knew Brown on Shakespeare, you know, whatever. But what always blew me away about that movie was the costume design, the production design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That movie was, it was different. I mean, it wasn't Braveheart, you know, or Gibson's Hamlet, like in terms of that, like, realistic Dark Ages look. You know, it didn't go for, it was almost anachronistic, almost Excalibur-esque, but just so gritty.
And the way they managed to do, I mean, sort of combined with that is, I don't think that movie cost a lot of money.
No.
But it looks like,
you
know, it looks like basically just the smartest use of smaller sets. I mean, they definitely did not have Hamlet type money to work with.
Well, look at that. Look at the scene, Armored Ultimatum with Exeter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, you're in this dimly lit room. There's, I think, four candles in the room and a fire pit.
Yeah.
And everyone's gathered around it. And Hamlet, this is something I think it does. It really helps it escape from just the encompassing shadow of the 1944 Laurence Olivier version of it.
Yeah.
Is that Branagh takes all the pomp and all of the spectacle and just throws it the fuck to the side.
Yeah, whittles it down to three people.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, 16 years before the term would be coined, Batman Begins Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And yanks out all the perfume and tapestry portrayals that filmgoers are accustomed to.
Yeah.
You know, the skies are gray and cold. The exteriors bleed chilly and damp.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like a miserable, miserable autumn.
Mm-hmm. If I'm not getting my wires crossed, wasn't there like a kick-ass fight scene in that movie too?
Yes, there was the Battle of St. Crispin's.
Yeah,
or the Battle of, I forget the name of the place in France.
Yeah,
it's the St. Crispin's Day thing.
Yeah,
but
also, I mean, I just wanted to briefly touch on, you know, when you say the sort of the production, I hate to use this term, but the mise en scène of the Exeter Ultimatum scene.
I hate to use this term when I'm actually in the same room as you guys, so you can throttle me, but
I'm wearing a pink shirt. You know, Steve, you mentioned it was almost anachronistic, but something I really appreciated was that here you were supposedly in sort of the lap of luxury, and they treated it appropriately. You know, for a Middle Ages king who had tons of money, you would have some tapestries and some very nice fabrics, but you would still be, you know, you'd be heating with one fireplace, and it would feel dark, just like it would in any other place.
It didn't feel extravagant.
Yeah, you know? It felt like an appropriate depiction of wealth and power, and in contrast
in
to...
In 1300s.
Yeah, and, you know, because it comes after some really sort of ugly kind of hovel scenes with a very young Christian Bale, actually, speaking of Batman Begins. It, you know, it feels appropriate. You don't feel like this is small scale, but...
I think he used the duelist's trick. You know, the Ridley Scott, the duelist's trick. The whole... Everything they had was in frame. You know, like there's a shot in the duelist, and Ridley points it out in the commentary to duelists when the guys are inside the tent talking, like, one soldier's briefing a commander about, you know, having delivered the thing to Keitel and all of this. And you see outside, like, horses going back and forth. You see armored soldiers. It was actually two horses and four guys. But it looked like a bustling, you know, military operation because really just had the same guys keep moving back and forth in front of the opening of the tent.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that Branagh really employed here, you know?
Most of the movie is framed with medium to close shots, right? It brings you in a lot tighter. And the acting.
Yeah, and the Exeter scene. I mean, I keep going back to that
scene. God, the acting.
But
That scene's one of the greatest things
I've ever seen. It's the subtlest acting I've ever seen from Blessed. Brian Blessed.
Yeah, but he's still, like, Brian Blessed walks into that scene.
He owns it.
In full chainmail.
Yeah.
Like a fucking bull. With the most mercenary swagger I've ever
and
seen.
And, like, I mean, like, they make you feel like this is a crowded courtroom. They make you feel like there could be 30 or 40 or 100 people in this room, but all you see is two. All you see is,
and
you know?
The other thing I love about the performances in this movie is that they feel so present. A lot of the earlier Shakespeare adaptations, it feels as if they're kind of reaching back into the depths of history to conjure up this great play for your entertainment. But well, this one, you really feel like you're there in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that Shakespeare was writing about actual people, and he wanted them to be humans who were, you know, who actually came alive. And what I find about some of, you know, the Olivier adaptations and similar, it's like, we are now doing theater.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah.
So self-aware.
Well, what I would credit Henry V is that it does try to make it accessible to a modern audience. I think particularly of that scene early on where there's traitors or something, and they're interrogating people, and it feels like a scene from The Godfather.
Yeah. It's yeah. I just it feels like it, of the Shakespeare adaptations out there, it really feels like the most real.
And I think the best thing that could have happened to this movie is that it was Branagh at his hungriest when he really had something to prove, but he didn't have the resources to do it with. You know, once I don't think he ever really got out of that frame of mind of I have something to prove. But then, you know, he started getting serious money.
Yeah. Well, you've got Henry V, you know, versus something like Hamlet. Hamlet feels incredibly bloated. I mean, what do we say, 4.5 hours long? And
a cast of thousands.
Yeah.
A mad Danish merchant.
Yeah, and Henry V has a room with six people in it that feels like Brian Blessed standing in the middle of a Colosseum shouting at an emperor.
But, like, what's so brilliant about it is he manages to film it. So, like I said, it gives you the impression that you're in a room full of people, but all you see is Brian Blessed. You know, like, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant how it's done.
It's the best acting I've seen out of Branagh from him directing himself. you know, he masterfully dances between Prince Cal, who kind of, you know, reflects the ever-entertaining Falstaff and the wishful naivety of his old drinking buddies, and then the steely, intelligent when he's king, you know, King Henry, and holy shit, he's fucking Batman.
And I mean, the other thing too, you know, like you're looking at this. He was what? He was first time director with
28.
This movie, wasn't
he was 28 years old.
Wasn't that his first directing?
It was his first directing for film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, you had a guy who's not only is he doing Shakespeare, which is ridiculous, he's directing, which is also ridiculous, and he's starring for a 28-year-old man. Like that's pretty fucking, you know, that's a pretty amazing accomplishment, man.
And if he feels overconfident in some of his later work, you can almost understand why with him just knocking it out of the park to that degree his first time out.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I'd certainly be cocksure after that, you know? Like, I'd be like, hey, listen, man, I made Henry V. I'll do what I want, okay? You don't...
Sure, everybody's going to love a 4.5-hour version of
Henry. He would have turned to Orson Welles.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Know, like...
himself to death. Understand that what Kenneth Branagh ate is fat ass.
I cannot wait for Kenneth Branagh's drunken champagne commercial.
Does anybody else have wine reasonably priced at a dollar?
Anybody else have Henry V? Is there good?
Gabe?
No.
Well, who wants to go next?
Clark, I'm forcing it.
I'll do it. And I'll go not to Branagh's next film, but a relatively close follow-up, Much Ado About Nothing, his next Shakespeare film, certainly, from, I think it's what, 1993? And the thing I love about this movie is that it really captures the essence of Shakespeare's comedy better than any other Shakespeare adaptation I've seen. It's really funny, unlike a lot of cinematic adaptations of Shakespeare comedies. It helps that he's working from a pretty rock-solid play, but he really reinvigorates that story and finds a way to make it fresh for a modern audience without compromising any of the actual play's integrity. And the casting is brilliant throughout.
I'm just thinking now about the late 90s Midsummer's Night Dream. Oh, boy.
I will say, I mean, casting Denzel Washington was brilliant.
Yes.
Yeah. In that movie. Sorry, but I didn't want to interrupt. But I
But I agree.
I almost wanted to pick this as my good. Only reason I didn't is because there is the Keanu factor, and I think it's been eclipsed by the Joss Whedon adaptation, which I just think is, it may be the, along with Henry V, it may be the best Shakespeare adaptation I've seen.
I have one sort of major problem with the Joss Whedon adaptation, and that's that certain elements of the story just ring false. In a modern setting, yeah, it just that part of it doesn't work for me.
People caring about virginity and so forth when they're wearing Armani.
What's that?
People caring about virginity and honor when they're all wearing Armani.
well, sure, and you know the whole conflict between Hero and her father and everything. It just feels very, weirdly archaic.
It does. I think it depends on how much I buy into it because I know that it comes from a certain era, and so I find it as easy to take as the Branna version. And I think Fillion, as much as I love Keaton, is a better Dogberry than Keaton is.
That's a tough choice, but they're both really fun performances.
The thing is, I find Fillion is playing the material in order to tell the story best and bring out the laughs, and Keaton is playing it to be as zany and bring as much attention to his character as possible.
I haven't seen the...
He farts and wakes himself up.
But anyway, I am pulling this whole thing off track, so I apologize.
But yeah, it's a really fun movie. And even Keanu, who is obviously the weak point of the cast, still kind of amuses me with his performance. There's a bit midway through where he has to do an evil laugh, and it is the most entertainingly bad evil laugh I've ever heard. And for that alone, I just kind of treasure that performance.
I love Keanu. Like, with that one and Dracula, like, around the same area, and all, like, he got so much shit for Dracula. And, you know what, he was so goddamn earnest. I can't help but root for the guy.
I like Keanu in a lot of things. I think he has a range, and he's very good, and actually, although the Day the Earth Stood Still remake was awful, I thought he was pretty good in it. But he is so far out of his depth.
He's out of his element. He is out of his element, you know?
He is Ted Theodore Logan, thrashing madly.
I give him credit for trying. I give him credit for being so damn earnest. And you can
stop
tell,
giving
you
people know? Credit for trying.
You can
we
tell.
We have to start
he's
giving
he's
them
trying.
Credit for succeeding.
Everyone's a winner.
See, I was the baseball. I was the Bad News Bears baseball coach. Okay.
No, but he was an asshole. You only ever saw the end of Bad News Bears on TV. You know, when Morris is giving a bear and they're all high-fiving, you didn't see the beginning when, you know, he's hung over sitting outside the pool.
No, yeah, I'm pretty much that coach.
Before we get into tales of child abuse. Go on, you were making a point.
I like Keanu in it. I mean, I kind of like Keanu anyway. I got a guilty pleasure for Keanu. You know, I kind of like watching Keanu movies. I get a kick out of the guy. I'm dying to see 47 Ronin, I'm not going to lie. You know?
Me too, actually.
I can't wait to see that movie. And when I see him in stuff like Dracula and Much Ado About Nothing and that, you know, like, when I see it, it's like, you know what? This is just some dude who got lucky and is able to live his dream, and more power to him, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, more power to him for it.
Mm-hmm. The fact and that he takes the skin off chicken.
Yeah. But yeah, I enjoyed the movie for what it was. I mean, you know, I'm not as keen on it. I'd say it's closer to a bad myself than a good. But I've never been a fan of the Shakespearean comedy. I could never get into that mindset, you know?
I do want to say one thing that's really worth mentioning in this is it is one of the other examples of Branagh being able to direct himself very well. And no one, I think, has ever said the line, "the world must be peopled," and sold it so well as a laugh as he has.
I mean, it's tough. It's especially when you get into a comedy, it's really tough for, like, in the 21st century, or the 20th century in this case, for actors to really be able to portray the humor with that dialogue, with that language, you know, and the fact that they pulled it off is pretty admirable, you know? It is, I mean, I've seen a ton of Shakespeare on stage by amateurs, and, you know, like, and a lot of these guys are great actors. I mean, shout out to my homeboy, Mr. Kevin Woolridge. He's a fantastic actor, and he does an amazing job of Shakespeare. But a lot of the other people who've acted with him and stuff, doing Shakespeare and that kind of stuff, is, you know, when you see amateurs trying to pull off Shakespeare, and even when you see a lot of Hollywood talent try to pull off Shakespeare, it, I mean, do I even need to mention Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet?
But,
really? Yeah.
But you have Emma Thompson also. It's someone worth mentioning.
Yes. But, you know, it's the fact that they pulled it off so well.
I want to see...
Clark, tell us you're good so we can jump all over it and not let you...
I really want to see that Denzel stage production in Desert Storm.
Oh. Sorry, Clark.
I was also going to say that it's a tough call between this and Henry V for me in terms of the music, but they're my two favorite Patrick Doyle scores. Just brilliant, brilliant stuff for both of those. And especially in the case of Henry V, it's hard to believe it was his very first film score. But it's just fantastic. And he captures the drama and the comedy so well and has these great, big, sweeping, wonderful themes. And I don't know. I mean, he's done some fine stuff over the course of his career.
To the horses sort of rising up as they, you know, to these big notes that works just beautifully.
And wrote a couple of great songs to Shakespeare's text for both of these, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see that in a lot of Shakespeare adaptations, and most of the time the songs are actually kind of crappy. And I'd point to the Joss Whedon version of Much Ado About Nothing as one of these.
Yeah.
That's a crappy little song in that movie. But
but it works perfectly as a sort of, like, easy listening background for a part in this kind of Hollywood environment for it. But
it does.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, it's fine. Let's move on. Let's move on. Fine. You can have the kids this weekend. I don't even care.
Gabe.
For my good, I went to In the Bleak Midwinter. This is rather not well-known Branagh movie. It's about a group of amateur actors who are trying to put on a Hamlet production. It's kind of shot a bit... at first it starts as a fake documentary, and then it turns in kind of like, I guess, Woody Allen doing Ingmar Bergman kind of style, just the look of the movie. But it is so British and so funny at the same time. The basic story is very well worn out, but the peculiar beats that it hits and some of the lines and the performances are just really funny. It's a movie that I found the most fun. To be completely honest, I'm not a Shakespeare person. I mean, if for Anglophone people, Shakespeare is hard to understand, imagine for a person whose first language is French.
Yeah, really.
Most of the time, I don't understand
Quebec
what
French.
The heck.
At that.
You speak French?
Most of the time, I don't understand what the hell they're saying, and I'm lost in the Shakespeare movies, and I really have to strain to understand what's going on. I still can enjoy them, but, you know, to me, I don't find them fun because I have to work so much.
It's also worth pointing out that you probably don't appreciate the beauty of just the sound of the language, given that you love German so much.
It is like typewriters eating tinfoil getting kicked down the stairs.
But yeah, I mean, it's funny because at the same time that the basic story is fairly unpretentious and very much a laugh, the way he filmed the movie is kind of pretentious. Like I said, the tricks of Woody Allen doing Bergman, very static shots, black and white, you know, like, oh, this is serious stuff. But what's going on in the movie undercuts it. Anyways, I found it a very big bit of fun.
I was actually intrigued with it, and I hadn't really been familiar with it other than the name and the premise. And then you said Ingmar Bergman and Woody Allen combined, and those are two of my least favorite things in the world about movies, so I kind of checked out at that point.
I'm just talking about the way it's filmed.
Breaking a bottle and stabbing Steve in the neck.
I'm just talking about the way he filmed it, you know?
Okay.
The basic, you know, it's still a... That's what intrigued me the most, is like, he films it that kind of way, you know, kind of serious and black and white and lot of shadows, lots of close-ups, lots of still moments. But the general story is extra funny and very British.
British humor kind of definitely appeals to me.
It's a fun little movie that I find would be good to rediscover. Like the only I also liked his lesser known Peter's Friends, which kind of feels the same. The kind of group of misfit group of people that connect together.
Like the Phil.
It's just fun to me to see kind of a Brana like loosen up a little, because most of the time he seems to be going for 11, you know?
Yeah.
Look at me! I am amazing! Woohoo!
Does Brana like do his trademark Brana manic flip outs in these movies?
Brana is not in Midwinter's Tales. It's one of the few movies where he directed that he's not in.
Oh, okay.
The main character, I don't know who's the main guy who played it, but he kind of reminded me of Steve Coogan.
Okay.
That kind of energy.
I love when Brana does his flip outs. I think Brana, like, he does manic really, really
well. Yes, he is really good. But yeah, I think it's a fun movie. And that's all I have to say. I had a lot of fun with it. I don't know if it's his best movie, but it's the one that I definitely enjoyed the most.
Right on. I guess that's just me, is it?
Yep.
I'm going to totally destroy whatever level of class we had built up to this point. And I'm going to pick my good. I'm going to just lay it all out there. Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit is actually my good.
The movie loses 25% of its overall grade thanks to the subtitle.
That title,
you think
is
this is game, Steve?
That title is absolutely fucking terrible. Yeah.
Before you go any further, movie studios, never name your movie after the main character ever again.
No,
stop doing it.
And was it also maybe advertised as Tom Clancy's
Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit? Even Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, I can get behind, but Shadow Recruit, what the fuck? Really?
Recruited from the shadows, or by the shadows.
Oh, Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan, Pandora Tomorrow.
And all the trailers
peanut butter helped.
All the trailers made this movie look like, you know, another Bourne Rip or another Casino Royale, you know? Dark and gritty and action-filled and just a nasty, nasty action movie in the 21st century vibe, you know, which just happened to have Kenneth Branagh classing it up a little bit as the villain. It's not. It's not even remotely that. The trailers were horribly misleading.
But there was a helicopter that blew up. I think.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there was a helicopter that blew up. There was something on fire. There might have been something on fire.
There was a very fast ambulance.
But it's really not an action movie. It is an espionage flick, and it is
hit with a missile in the opening scene.
I remember that from the trailer.
Yes, it does.
But that's
But anyway, it's, you know, it is an espionage flick. It is very much in the same vein as like The Hunt for Red October, Clear and Present Danger. I'm not going to mention Patriot Games because it sucked, but Chris Pine plays a fantastic Jack Ryan. He's excellent. Branagh's villain is, again, absolutely fantastic. And he actually does a really good job with the Russian, despite the, this is no game, Jack.
his introduction into the movie with the heroin scene.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah. And he's mean. It's a surprisingly, I can't say intellectual, because it's not an intellectual film. It is still, you know, an espionage Hollywood flick. But it's cerebral, I guess is the word I'd use. You know, it is more like, you know, Chris Pine's
more
character.
More of a, like, Len Dayton type. Harry, what his face, Michael Caine going to Berlin and doing that
The Ipcris file and stuff like that. It is that style of, and it is, you know, it's still a Jack Ryan movie.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the scenes that look very Casino Royale-ish in the trailer, you know, him killing the guy in the hotel room and some guy just tried to kill me, you know.
You're not an analyst in here, Jack. You're operational now.
Yeah, and Costner. Costner is fucking phenomenal in this movie.
Terrific couple therapy scenes.
Yeah.
I assume from the trailer.
But it's, you know, it's well acted, it's well performed, it stays true to the character, and Branagh directs the shit out of it. He really does a fantastic job. The action sequences are nice, they're smooth, they're not too erratic, they're not chopped to pieces like you're watching Paul Greengrass, you know. It's it is a really well executed flick, and it is, like, it's...
I mean, I got the sense, I haven't seen this, but I got the sense from Thor that he got very excited about having a bigger playground.
Yeah, yeah.
You
and
know,
it,
once, like, this Hollywood money. And
it does feel like, I mean, like, the movie does have that.
He knows how to frame a shot, though. Brennan knows how to frame the shit out of a
shot.
Oh,
he does.
That scene
really
of Jack
does.
Standing in, I always forget the film's name, Victor whatever.
Yeah.
Kenneth
Branagh.
Yeah. Sitting in Brunofsky's office, or standing in the Brunofsky's office, and it's like the, you know, like Russian, it's like Russian New Age office design, and you got the great big window behind him, and just Moscow laid out everywhere in piss pouring rain.
Yeah, it's beautifully shot, it's beautifully acted. Pine is an amazing Jack Ryan. He's
and
way
beautiful.
Better. Well, okay.
Yeah, I was just trying to follow
all
your
that, all
series.
That scar tissue on his face makes him so attractive. But, no, you know, he does do a fantastic job as Ryan. He's closer to Alec Baldwin than Harrison Ford. You know, he does that style. And, like, it's got a plot that really propels you forward. You know, it keeps you invested, keeps you going. And we sat down and watched it. Four of us sat down and watched it last weekend. Wasn't it, Sarah, we watched that?
Yes.
And all of us were like, man, this is a really good movie. We were all expecting The Bourne Identity or Casino Royale. You know, we were expecting nonstop action. And we were watching it, and we're just like, man, this is actually a really good, like, we're into this. We're all really into this. And it's smaller than you'd think. Like, you hear 21st century Hollywood spy movie, you think globetrotting, but it's actually a pretty small, like, pretty intimate little story. It doesn't have this huge, like, it's not these colossally high stakes and all of this until the final act. But, you know, it doesn't really feel like this huge, larger-than-life movie. The closest comparison I could give would be the first Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movie. It's got a lot of that vibe to it, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's encouraging to hear, too, because the trailers...
All fears.
What? The trailers look so underwhelming to me.
Yeah, and when I saw
They were so bad that somebody offered me a free ticket to go see the movie, and I lied to them and told them I was busy, even though I had nothing going on at all that day. But
I had zero interest in it. I really had.
And you were convincing. You'd make an excellent spy.
I really had no interest in seeing it. I had next to zero interest in seeing it after seeing the trailer. It was like, oh, great, another Bourne movie. They took a really cool, like, one of the only good, memorable characters to come out of the 90s action scene outside of John McClane, and they totally ruined him. But no, Pine does a fantastic job, right?
Just to play devil's advocate here, though, is Jack Ryan really that memorable a character? I mean, what's Jack Ryan's
He's
defining?
Just an analyst.
Sure.
It's not so much the character, because the character can be interpreted in a number of ways. I mean, there's no way that Affleck and Ford and
Baldwin
were really playing the same character. I don't think. It's more the idea of being in over your head in a non-diehard kind of way.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, in a realistic fashion. You know, in a realistic fashion. And I think a lot of it, like, I say, you know, memorable, but I remember Baldwin. Yeah, so, you know, Affleck surprised the shit out of me as Jack Ryan. Ford was Ford, but it's always Baldwin and Hunt for Red October that I remember. That's what I associate with Jack Ryan, like the character of the franchise.
He really, I mean, he sold more than any of the others the insecurity about going into the field and having things be, you know, these stakes resting on his expertise.
Yeah.
And
next time you get a bright idea, Jack, put in a memo.
And that's the thing about Shadow Recruit. Shadow Recruit feels like The Hunt for Red October. It feels like that character again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously a reboot. It's obviously re-kickstarting the whole franchise kind of thing. Whether or not they get a franchise out of it is anybody's guess, but...
Mm-hmm. Did it make money?
It did make money.
It cost $60 million, and they made over $130 million on it.
Okay. Yeah, so, I mean, it made money. But big thing with it was, you know, it feels like that kind of a property. It feels like that kind of a film. It doesn't feel like this rock'em sock'em spy thriller that was advertised until you get to the final act, which, again, I won't get into. But, you know, Shadow Recruit's my good.
Cool. You're in charge.
Cool.
John, you have to move this thing along.
Okay, so moving on from the good, the natural choice after good would be bad.
It's up for debate.
So we're going to move on to our bads. And, myself and Forbes went first last time.
Yeah.
I'm going to go first again. You selfish bastard. Ego maniac.
You son of a bitch.
Well, it's even better when you get to realize I'm going to pull a McVeigh and not choose an ugly.
Oh.
Or I'm just going to say Peter's friend is my ugly because Gabe likes it. my bad is one I've got a... I enjoyed the hell out of when I was younger. I've never been able to bring myself to go back to it. But I thought caught a lot of unnecessary flack, and that's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Again, I thought it was a movie that was shot really well. I love the sets. I love the look of the movie. I love a lot of the performances outside of De Niro, but I love his whole standing in front of a flaming cabin yelling out, Frankenstein!
He really had no business. He had less business being in that movie than Keanu had being in Much Ado.
Yeah. I was going to get to that, actually. If we're going to rag on Keanu in Much Ado About Nothing, we have to bring up Robert De Niro in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But
speaking of actors who don't have range, really.
Yeah. I loved a lot of stuff. I love a lot of the surprises in it. There's a great twist in it with... Helena Bonham Carter as Brown's love interest that now as a man in his 30s I'd see coming a mile away, but as a 12-year-old I thought was the coolest little twist ever.
And a callback to
the Universal movies.
Yeah.
And her exit out of the movie 30 seconds after that is shot amazingly well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Where Mary Shelley's Frankenstein falls apart for me is the opening third of that movie is a fucking mess in editing. It's just trying
Wasn't that movie cut to shit, too, though?
Yes, it feels like they're trying to squeeze in an hour's worth of footage into 25 minutes.
I think what Brandon was originally filming was meant to be a lot longer than what ended up.
Wasn't it like a 90-minute movie by the time?
Yeah,
90-minute movie, and I think like there's 10 of it is him dying on... I always forget the actor's name. Colin something, big in the late 80s
or
90s.
Was it like someone Quinn? Or?
Yeah, just, no, yeah, sorry, that's why I'm thinking Colin, because Colin Quinn. No, Aidan Quinn.
Aidan Quinn.
Yeah, dying on...
Yeah.
Anthony.
Yeah. Dying, wouldn't it be awesome if it was Anthony Quinn as the captain of the boat? Yeah, but 10
Anthony
minutes...
Anthony Quinn's amazing.
I know!
One of the great things about the Aidan Quinn character is that... he acted as this window into the period where Bram Stoker's Dracula and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein sort of came out at the same time and completely confused the shit out of Roger Ebert. Because in his review for Bram Stoker's Dracula, he talks about this brief scene with Aidan Quinn as a ship captain.
Yeah, but it's like, it's just... The scenes with Aidan Quinn as the ship captain, what I'm assuming they're trying to find passage, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great little closure to the movie, but again, it's 10 minutes of a 90-minute movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but I always remember just, it's really frantically paced,
mm-hmm.
but the opening of it feels like it wants to be more methodical.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Frankenstein...
Like, there needs to be a build-up in his character in terms of gradually pushing beyond what's been allowed, and...
Yeah, like, it's not so much... It feels more like, you know, my mentor died, and now I'm going to go crazy and try to bring people back from the dead, instead of, this whole obsession of him, you know, it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it goes from about 3 to 11 in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he goes batshit. like snap a finger.
There's a lot of water in this movie. There's an awful lot of like rain and shit.
And it also felt like he wanted a lot of symbolism, too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're going to shoot electric eels out of something that looks like a ball sack for the creation scene.
Oh, no.
And De Niro gets one great line in the movie and fucking mangles it. This whole, I'm possessed of love you could never understand and a rage you could not comprehend. And if I'm not free to... If I'm not free to exercise one, I will indulge the other.
Mm-hmm.
And he still thinks he's doing Raging Bull, and it's terrible.
I think part of the problem there too is that it feels like De Niro's in a different movie from everybody else because he's clearly trying to make this character.
He's trying to play, you know, a mafioso heavy,
right? And he's trying, you know, not to do the Boris Karloff thing and to make this character. What he terms real and convincing and authentic, and I don't think Branagh really has that much interest in that. He's making this great big opera of a movie.
Well, I mean, I think it would have been more interesting if they'd gone back to the novel and made the monster sort of beautiful, instead of trying to do sort of grosser than Karloff. And
did the whole the Galatean.
Mm-hmm.
I think if they had just done what Coppola did with Dracula. Go back to the source material and interpret the source material and
it was a series. It was like, it was Bram Stoker's Dracula, this is Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but no, it's not Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
No.
It's James Whale's Frankenstein.
Yeah. And that's another thing, too. Like, a lot of people don't remember the movie fondly. Kind of, you know, it's left in the wake of Bram Stoker's Dracula, which I know was kind of divisive. I always loved it.
Oh, me too.
Coppola's Dracula is a fucking masterpiece to me.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
And Mary Shelley.
I know where the bastard lives.
That line aside.
My darling Dina.
Yeah, but then right after that, man, you get the. Could you point me in the direction of the cinematograph machine?
The greatest blue sunglasses of all time.
It's blue t-shirt. I am told
you guys need to keep this for the Coppola episode.
Yes.
I would have crossed oceans of time
to see Mary Shelley's Frankenstein on
the
cinema.
Well, I'm a giant bat.
Gary Oldman, this summer, Gary Oldman is Count Chocula.
Oh, deviations.
But at the same time, I feel that the Frankenstein's greatest strength and its greatest fault is that Branagh goes thick and very thick with the cheese in this movie.
Well, yeah, look, Anderson, he's trying to make this big grand opera. He's making this big theatrical production, and it falls apart because, you know, the monster wants to be something else.
Yeah.
You know, he's got no control over the monster. It's edited down, like, edited horribly. Because, I mean, you've got just the beginning of the movie where you need to lay the root for Victor's obsession. And, you know, this guy, he goes back and forth from sane to crazy to sane to crazy to sane to crazy.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest problem with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is that Robert De Niro is in it, and I just...
If you had someone who could play sympathetic monsters like Gary Oldman, for example, and
John Hurt,
and studio interference, and maybe if... Although I think Branagh was good in the movie... If he'd been able to focus more on directing and not be so in the center of it as its protagonist.
Yeah, well, okay, it was 1994. Get some... Hugh Grant was up and coming then, wasn't he?
Yeah, there you go.
Get some pretty English actor up and coming.
Or like a young Colin Firth.
Yeah,
there we go.
I don't recall, but how did the movie do at the box office? Does anyone know? Was it a big flop?
I recall it being a big disappointment. I seem to recall it basically being swept under the rug.
Well, because Dracula came up first,
Dracula
and
was
it was
no
sort of
right.
phenomenon
yeah.
of sorts.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was...
But Dracula was kind of one of those situations where it was almost as reviled as it was loved, and it had this really infamous reputation.
I think,
you know?
It caught
the popular imagination.
Yeah, yeah.
In the way that maybe they weren't even expecting it to.
I mean, but it was such a... Like, I recall Dracula just being this infamous movie, man. Like, you know, people were like, oh my god, like, you...
Guys, it actually did pretty good. Cost $45 million, did 112.
Oh, okay. Oh wow.
Okay.
But I think probably a lot overseas.
I can't remember. Did this come out before or after Interview with the Vampire?
Same year, I think.
Same year, yeah.
Same time of the year.
Well, hang on. Was Interview with the Vampire 93 or 94?
I thought they were both 94, but I may be wrong.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, I'm kind of thinking it came out after Interview with the Vampire, and it's kind of like... That kind of feels like the direction he's going with it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Only it's not nearly, you know, the color isn't nearly as vibrant, it's not as warm feeling, and the monster really, really sucks.
Yeah.
And, well, Robert De Niro's in it. Oh,
and there's no Antonio Banderas phonetically performing.
But just watch it for Helena Bonham Carter. That scene is fantastic.
There you go.
I love that ridiculously long flowing red dress she wears too late in the movie, which is just like maybe the most over the top thing in a film full of them, but it's just gorgeous.
That's sort of I remember that as like that to me is the that's sort of signifies the intent of the movie as this grand operatic thing. Remember that dress, and it's like, yes, this is what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that it was cut to pieces. That's why I think the movie was really slashed to bits, you know? Stuff like that gives me the impression that he was really...
Well, studio wanted a horror movie.
No, yeah. Okay, I can't remember. How's his delivery of It's Alive? I can't remember what he did with it.
Very manic.
It's alive!
Doesn't he, like, slip in the, like...
In the primordial fluid? Yes. There's this very homoerotic fight with the monster in the ooze.
In the electric eel womb.
Moving on.
Speaking of cheese, I think I will go next. For my bad, I chose Dead Again. Just look at the synopsis for a second. This is about a woman with amnesia wires a private detective who then takes her to a hypnotist who makes her regress to her past life in which her and the detective are both in a relationship together and the detective is supposed to kill her in the past life. This is basically the soap opera movie. But Branagh knows this, and he directs the shit out of it. It's a movie that shouldn't work by any other, you know, it's a romance novel or something. But he makes it work. I mean, the only other movie that I've ever seen that does this good is Wolfgang Petersen's Shattered.
Shattered.
Yeah, but it's that type of thing where it takes this crazy kind of plot and makes it work, but at the same time, you know, it is
a modern or I guess early 90s sort of spin on Vertigo, this kind of mixture of a mystery film with hints of the supernatural and sort of reincarnation and obsession and but without, you know, Hitchcock.
The big difference between this one and Shattered, Gabe, is Dead Again's got the kind of whole supernatural thing. Shattered just had a twist that didn't work, but the movie just didn't fucking care.
Yeah. I mean, Dead Again, it's definitely in the realm of a B movie, but it's filmed like an A movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he directs the shit out of it, and it oozes with atmosphere.
Didn't Frank write it?
Yeah, Scott Frank wrote it.
Okay. And, you know, it feels to me like a closer approximation of an actual Alfred Hitchcock movie than a lot of the movies Brian De Palma did back in the 70s and early 80s when he was so obviously wanting to make Hitchcock movies. I don't necessarily think it's better than those, but
I actually thought
it feels more like it captures sort of the spirit of a big studio Hitchcock flick.
Mm-hmm.
It captures that spirit of, I mean, there was this sort of period, I mean, I guess
Vertigo was sort of later 50s, but I tend to think of it more in the 40s, and I'm struggling to come up with an example, but it feels to me like there, I guess Rebecca, it's this sort of pseudo-mystical, you know, tied in with sort of fears of going mad, and sort of unsure about people's identities, and I don't know if there's actually a genre of movies that kind of you can neatly fit these into, but it definitely feels like a callback to a certain era.
And another reason why it's a bad, it might be the beginning of casting Robin Williams as a psychologist or a failed psychologist, so it's got that against it.
Jesus, I completely blocked that out.
You're right to do that, because I can't think of a single instance in which Robin Williams makes something better.
If memory serves, isn't he basically like a cameo in this movie?
Yeah, he is a cameo.
I remember sort of, most of my memories of this movie are, you know, A, sort of what I've talked about, this general sense of its feeling like an earlier type of movie, and being entertained, but then sort of the very last couple of scenes going totally off the rails into like bonkers cheese land.
Yes.
with Derek Jacobi being awful when he started really well in the movie.
My other memory of this movie is that Andy Garcia has the worst old age makeup of all time.
Yes.
And I don't even remember the context of why he was reappearing as an old man. It's been a while, but I remember that he looked awful.
Because the Kenneth Branagh character in the past life is supposed to have told him a secret before dying or something because he was a reporter.
I'd rather not know. I think it's appropriate to this movie that I just have vague memories of having seen it sometime in an earlier life.
But yeah, I mean, it's a pretty good movie to watch on a rainy afternoon, but it's not much more than that, you know.
They should put that on the case.
Used to watch on a rainy afternoon, right now.
And they're all on YouPorn, right, Steve?
YouPorn is. I assume the word porn is in the title, so I kind of get the gist of it.
Actually, it's a news site.
Oh, okay, never mind. Yeah, I have no real recollection of Dead Again. I know I've seen it, but it's one of those movies that's just so amorphous that, you know, it just...
And now, as a They Came From the North first, we're going to do a live hypnotism.
He's going to start screaming uncontrollably.
Steve, you're sitting on your couch. It's a rainy Sunday afternoon.
You're making out.
You're watching
with this suave composer played by Kenneth Branagh.
No. Can't make me relive. No.
Show them the doll where they touch you.
Fuck you guys. I'm going next.
All right.
I'm only picking this as a bad because I couldn't pick it as a good because I picked something else as a good. I'm again going to take the totally mainstream, unpretentious route. I'm just going to say Thor.
How rote.
Because I fucking love that movie, man. I really did.
Thor,
I,
Lord of Thunder and Jesus.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, all signs pointed to it being absolutely wretched and awful and terrible. You know, all the early screenshots and on-set photos of all the characters in their extremely garish costumes. And
which played beautifully, but in
amazingly,
the silly...
Yeah. Still, it looked terrible. Awful. It looked terrible. Everything about the movie looked awful. It looked like the, you know, the first real colossal failure of the Marvel Films enterprise, you know? And it was awesome. It was extremely entertaining. I'll pick it as a bad because...
You didn't watch any of the others.
No, I'll pick it as a bad because... there were certain elements of it that I felt were a little undercooked.
It's a very basic story.
It is a very basic story.
It could have been any superhero story, any superhero origin type story, and they just plugged Thor into it.
Well, I mean, all the Marvel movies have been that since.
And they also, I mean, this is also the case with Iron Man. They front loaded all the really spectacular stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then by the time the climax came,
yeah.
it was like, oh, it's what's his face, Gort.
Tell Gort Patu Parata Nito.
And I don't know whether any of you feel this way, but
out of the Dungeons and Dragons movie.
I don't know whether any of you feel this way, because Thor is my bad too. But I feel like Brenau kind of loses interest in the movie whenever he wanders back to Earth. I feel like the Asgard stuff he's really, really invested in, and I think it plays really well.
And I kind of agree to an extent, but contrary to Brenna, and I think this more has to do with the screenwriting and the editing than anything, but contrary to Brenna's, you know, like I agree with you totally. I think he does get bored with the Earth stuff, but I think that's where the life of the movie is. I really do. I think that's where the story actually progresses.
You get some fantastic comic moments that are beautifully tied into
with Darcy.
Yeah. And stuff that's beautifully tied into, you know, what Thor's going through is. He's a real asshole, and he keeps getting tased and run over with Land Rovers, and
the
eventually basically just, like, amazing. Beaten down until he's like, oh, actually.
I love the coffee scene, you know? Like, yeah. He smashes the cup on the...
Another! This beverage pleases me! No, I loved the... And not because I'm, you know, got the throbbing man crush for Chris Hemsworth or anything. I love the...
I can see your throbbing man crush right now, John.
No, waking up in the hospital bed and all the doctors fighting to restrain him. And it will take more villains than you to hold down the mud. And they haul the pants out, stab him in the ass with a tranquilizer. And just it's total... cartoon tranquilizer, dead stop, yeah. He's out.
But, I mean, the other thing, I think they were very smart to, embrace the silliness of Thor as a character in the modern thing, but at the same time point out that it was silly. Something as simple as, you know, Natalie Portman going in, trying to find him at the hospital and saying, his name is Thor? Like, as obviously stupid as that is.
Yeah.
But then when it comes time to do the really operatic stuff back on whatever their world is called, they don't really sort of condescend when they're playing that material. They, you know, it's, you feel like this is a real relationship between him and his father. When it's on Earth, it's sort of silly, and when it's on Asgard,
it becomes this pathos.
It becomes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very classical drama. Yeah,
exactly.
It's really well acted.
Yeah,
very well acted.
And it was nice to see that Hopkins didn't seem to be really slumming.
Yeah, and that's I thought it was going to be Anthony Hopkins on autopilot, and then when you see the stills of him in the ridiculous gold-plated Jack Kirby nightmare costume that looks amazing on film.
It's like, I will stand in front of the camera, but I won't like it.
I don't know if any of you read it, but he did an interview shortly after Thor came out where he was saying that he had been considering retiring from acting and that Branagh pretty much renewed his interest because he actually challenged him and said, no, I don't like that. Why don't we try doing it this way? And really pushed him to, you know, do stuff, whereas a lot of actors have kind of been letting him do whatever he wanted for a while and sort of being really directed. You know, made him realize how much he enjoyed making movies.
I'm Welsh.
I honestly don't think, you know, that, like, I mean, everybody said, you know, oh, like, it looks like it's going to be Anthony Hopkins on autopilot and all that kind of stuff. I don't think Hopkins has an autopilot. I can't recall anything offhand that, like, I've seen him in that I could say, oh, look, it's Hopkins phoning it in, you know?
I would say
I think
Alexander.
Like, he'll invest.
You really thought he was phoning
something like
in Alexander?
I did. I didn't like his performance.
He has this bag of tricks,
and
he just kind of goes, I can use these, you know, yes, he has energy in his performance, and he has, I mean, unreal charisma, right?
Yeah.
But
yes.
I think you can tell the difference between when he's sort of coasting on his really crazy talent and experience, and when he actually seems to care.
When he's
invested. Well, there's a big difference between his performance in Red Dragon and his performance in Hannibal.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I love the look of Thor. And this is where we're going to get into the Dutch angles, because this movie is made of them.
Dutch angles? I was made of this!
I love the look of the movie.
Tim, can we start talking about Die Hard again?
This is a... I really thought it was going to be the first Marvel movie I wasn't going to like.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it turned out it's my favorite of what they call Phase 1.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's like... painfully, painfully simple.
It is.
I think it's the Marvel movie that I've seen that reminds me the most of, you know, the actual Marvel comics back in the day.
Well, Gabe, it's this movie. It's Walt Simonson's run on Thor.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they didn't have Stan Lee writing this one.
Yeah.
They had someone who could actually fake old timey talk.
I guess
just throw more thous into it.
That's the big thing about why I consider it a bad, I think, is some of the plot stuff is just so contrived, like the whole, you know, the misunderstood brother turning villain. And I mean, like, it feels like it's done that way because it has to be that way.
Yeah.
It's done that way because, well, we're writing Thor and we're writing Loki, and Loki has to be the villain.
When it was created, you know, you had this fantastic artwork, but it was basically just, let's very simplistically ape Shakespearean tropes, right?
Yeah.
Mm. Now,
Tom Hiddleston, too, for making him
that's true
more interesting than he would be on the page.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. I mean, like, he is horribly written, but Hiddleston acts it amazingly well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I don't think I appreciated what Branagh brought to the movie fully until I saw Thor 2. Which kind of tries to pull off the same balance of, you know, serious dramatic stuff on Asgard and comic stuff on Earth, and it's just so clunky.
Oh, I just said earlier that anyone who made fun of the Dutch angles in Thor missed the creative desert that was Thor 2.
Thor 2. Like, it was a slick, it was commercial, it was fun, it was utterly forgettable.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, like Captain America and Captain America and Winter Soldier.
No. Because Winter Soldier was, although it wasn't a great plot, it wasn't super well written, was fucking directed incredibly.
Okay, fair enough. Thor, that was my bad.
We shall now fight, Steve.
Clark, it was your bad too, right?
Buggy Dome.
Yes, it was my bad as well.
We are kindred spirits, Clark and I.
Indeed. Have I gone?
No, you haven't.
All right. I'm going to go with Hamlet.
No. You need to wait for Hamlet.
No. Because here's the thing. Hamlet has some terrific stuff. It is really smart in the way it... I think he does some very good stuff with... actually, his portrayal of Hamlet in his quieter moments. I think... You know, he's got mostly a good cast in sort of the core group with Jacoby. I mean, Jacoby's amazing in this movie. Winslet, although she does, I mean, Ophelia calls for some overacting, so it's kind of forgivable. But mostly she's sort of quite sympathetic and, I mean, the production, as much as it's over the top, is beautiful. The few glimpses you get of young Norway guy from Dark City with amazing eyes.
Rufus Sewell.
Yeah. I mean, that's all great. Where it totally falls down, although not to the point of ugly for me by any stretch, is ridiculous stunt casting. The worst kind of... let's stuff this thing with celebrities to get people in seats casting. I appreciate that it's a full text performance of Hamlet, but unless you're in a very particular mood, it can be a chore to sit through. One thing that I think is impressive is it gets an amazing performance out of Charlton Heston, of all people.
Yes. Oh my God.
Which is a real accomplishment. But it's also an example of Branagh at his most pretentious, his most overconfident, especially in terms of him being able to create a character and maintain it and also run this massive production, because he goes way over the top in the showier parts. But generally speaking, I mean, obviously I think your mileage may vary. Some people think it's interminable. I've found for a, you know, 4 hour, 4.5 hour movie, when I've gone back to it, it's been surprisingly watchable, because although it's long, he does keep it moving. You know, every scene has a lot of energy. Who's the actor who's in... He plays Polonius in this. He's that great old British actor.
Is it the guy who's in Much Ado About Nothing?
Yeah.
He plays the father? Yeah, Richard Briers? Is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, Richard Briers.
Yeah, yeah. Briers.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's terrific as Polonius, and, you know, although he doesn't play it as broad comedy, he plays it very earnestly, but he makes sure that you understand that this is a ridiculous character who thinks far too highly of his own experience and wit and ability to navigate intrigue. As court intrigue movies go, I think it's a really compelling one, but it's just so over the top and tonally misguided in scenes. I mean, Billy fucking Crystal? Jesus.
The Panzer? What the fuck is the Panzer doing in this Shakespeare movie?
He's fine. I mean, he actually kind of plays it well. He's got his quiet little scene. But fucking Billy Crystal, Robin Williams, Jack Lemmon shows up at the beginning. Jack Lemmon, of all people, as, what, an 85-year-old guard with, what, a New York accent?
Verily, thou art.
I mean, he's a good actor and an intelligent actor, and he can handle the dialogue, but it just sounds fucking ridiculous coming out of his mouth.
Any more ridiculous than Tony Curtis in Spartacus?
Yeah, Lemon definitely seems to be fairly uncomfortable in that part, and I don't think I've really... I can't think of another instance where I've seen him uncomfortable in a role, but he really looks like he feels out of place in that movie.
He can play a whole bunch of things. He can play a bastard, he can play a sad sack. I mean, The Simpsons mined 20 seasons of a, you know, fourth-tier character out of one Lemon performance that's comedy and drama in one. I mean, he's done terrific stuff, obviously, with Wilder. But he is 100% American.
Yeah. There are some actors you just don't cast in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
You know? Mm.
Yeah.
And there are some actors, like Billy Crystal, who you do not allow their daily ration of oxygen.
Yeah. You exactly.
Put a bag over their head, fill it with glass shards.
Then you look like Schlemiel.
And, you know, I have to say, I would have thought Heston would have been on that list of actors you just don't cast in Shakespeare, but his big monologue might be the best scene of his career.
It's
I mean, perfect. It's insanely good.
Next to his work in Wayne's World 2.
I was about to say, it's Wayne's World.
No, it's Wayne's World 2.
Was that Wayne's World 2?
Yes. He's going to the wedding.
That's right, it was Wayne's World 2.
Do not test me, sir.
I once knew a girl on Gordon Street. But that was a long time ago.
Can we please get a better actor
here? What's his name tag? Chalk, isn't it?
Or True Lies. Come on now.
It's pretty good.
Jesus, Harry,
you screwed the pooch on that one.
Best part of that is his shit, he should have been Nick Fury.
He should have been Nick Fury. Yeah, I'm not the biggest fan. Is that all the goods?
Well, the bad.
That's all the bads.
Or all the bads. Sorry,
yeah.
My bad.
Yeah, I was at Hamlet. Kind of, it feels like it's Brenna's descent into like Cecil B. DeMille insanity.
Yeah,
like the movie is too long. It's too, you know, it's every if my enjoyment of Shakespeare as a young teenager was dependent on two things: the 1989 Henry V and gargoyles. Everything I loved about Henry V is Hamlet misses.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like,
well, I'm gonna caterwaul this right into my ugly. I'm gonna just, like, you know, segue right into ugly here, and I'm gonna say Hamlet was my ugly.
Hamlet's my ugly too. So we share this together.
Here we go. We have something in common, yeah, Mercer.
Well, I will say I think Hamlet deserves at least some credit though for, you know, actually getting the full complete text up there on the screen in a version that's not just a filmed play.
And it should be said that it's trying to be a totally different movie from Henry V.
Yeah.
It is.
Although
it
they're both tragedies, one is intrigue and one is bombast, right? And I think for sort of sprawling intrigue, it works. But now I'm talking more, and Steve's supposed to be talking about how terrible it is and making me cry.
I hate it. My
Hamlet is literature's first action hero.
Yeah. My thing with Hamlet, my introduction to Hamlet, of course, came in early high school. And we watched, there was an Olivier version of Hamlet, right?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Used to wonderful effect in Last Action Hero.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. We watched that one, and we did watch the Mel Gibson version.
Mm-hmm.
So my real enjoyment of Hamlet came out of the Mel Gibson version, because I mean, you know, you're looking at it roughly the same time frame as Braveheart and all that kind of stuff too. And I went back and revisited it after watching Braveheart. I owned a copy on VHS. I watched it a few times. I thought Gibson did a great job in that movie. I thought it was a really well acted movie, and I thought it looked fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then I saw.
Who directed that? Was that like a late Zeffirelli?
It was Zeffirelli.
Okay.
Yeah. I was about to say, it's a weird, yeah.
Anyway. That would get a lot of press, too, because it was different for Gibson.
Yeah, Gibson.
It's a really good sort of introduction to Shakespeare sort of flick, too, because it's kind of a greatest hits version of Hamlet.
For Priest Miller, Steve!
It is the cold sense version, you know. But my thing with... Then I went to Branagh's version, and, I mean, it does feel tonally completely different. And it didn't have any of the... I can't say life, because that's not the right word. But it didn't have any... It felt like it didn't have the passion that Gibson's had. It felt like it was more self-aware, more overtly theatrical, more... And it was all of what I hate about Shakespeare. It was all of that whole pomp, circumstance... Just, you know, we're a bunch of actors doing Shakespeare, you know, like, it had that whole rub it right in your face, you know.
There's something to be said for, you know, filmmakers who understand that Shakespeare was a popular entertainer.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I remember reading an interview with, I think it might have been Kenneth Branagh, actually, and he called Shakespeare the Michael Bay of his time, you know, which I thought was absolutely fucking brilliant. But, you know, like, It's a situation where with Hamlet, it was
just... it was Spielberg of his time.
Okay, fair enough. All right, the Wayne Gretzky of his time. But with Branagh's version,
Shakespeare getting one season?
I found it so long. I found it so arduous to sit through. Like, I found it... You know, I can sit down and watch Lawrence of Arabia like it's 20 minutes long, but when I sit down and watch Hamlet, it feels like 4 hours of movie, you know? And it gets to the point, especially when you got material like Shakespeare, where you really gotta, I won't say analyze, it's not that you have to be analytical when you're watching it, but like Gabe said earlier, you gotta work when you're watching Shakespeare, you know? Like, there is a certain degree of effort that goes into watching Shakespeare, and by the end of Hamlet, and maybe I am just a simplest, I don't know, but by the end of Hamlet, I was fucking exhausted, you know?
Well.
That was my...
Fair enough. You're wrong. But
okay.
I can't say that. I'm in your house.
Yes, you can. I don't give a shit.
He owns copies of Street Fighter. You can...
I own two copies of Street Fighter. Fuck you.
I'm not going
in case one is van damaged.
No, one's DVD and one's Blu-ray.
Okay. But I am not going home.
In case you really need the HD to see the amazing makeup effects on... what's-his-face? Baklava.
Character's name is Blanca.
Right.
You're obviously not down with the Street Fighter.
I was going to buy Ultra Street Fighter 4 so we could all play it after, and just...
Anyway, yeah, Hamlet, my ugly. I just don't like Hamlet.
John.
I already said why I don't like it.
Okay.
But like, this is why I was going to pull a McVeigh. I was going to be like, because Kenneth Branagh has never, you know, even directed what I consider an ugly. It's long, it's dry, and, you know.
It has all the character of white toast.
Yeah. It's not as good as Henry V.
It's Urge to kill. Rising.
Fine, okay. It has all the character of rye toast.
Yeah. And grain.
Ooh.
There's flax in here.
Sesame.
Toast and flax. Who's next? All right,
I'll go next. Don't put cheese on it. You're ruining it.
For my ugly, it's a movie that I would say isn't... I mean, it's certainly not nearly as bad as many of the uglies
we have discussed
on this podcast.
We have bumped some terrible uglies.
Yes. and get that out of my face! But as you like it, I think I forgot this movie as I was watching it, which made it really hard to follow.
As you like it, which is not...
It also doesn't help that, like, well, I can't really say objectively because I don't know what the popular consensus is, but as far as my experience with Shakespeare, and believe it or not, I've actually read a lot of Shakespeare, and I fucking hated As You Like It.
It's, I don't even, like, I was so confused through this movie, it felt, it was incredibly colorful, but it felt overstuffed, it felt cheap, even though... Obviously, they'd spent a lot of money on these costumes. It was it was so stagey. I mean, I've always thought it was one of the weaker comedies anyway. I never particularly warmed to it. It was a comedy, right?
Yeah.
Brian Blessed was in it, but he certainly was not at the level of Exeter or, in my opinion, Hamlet's...
Or Prince
Ghostfather, or Voldemort,
Lord Loxley.
There was this really bizarre approach to the design of the movie, which mixed sort of like cheapo fantasy with like Japanese-inspired costuming. And I think Kirsten Dunst was in it because she was on the cover of the DVD and was maybe the main character. But
I think you're thinking of Bryce Dallas Howard.
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay, Bryce Dallas Howard.
Who but seems a little out of her depth in that movie. In
mostly what I remember about this movie is the color yellow. and an inability to think clearly afterwards. So it felt like one of those... It felt like Branagh being incredibly indulgent, having no real control, really not succeeding at translating the dialogue as well as he did in other productions... I mean, this one really played like, I like Shakespeare a lot. I love the language. I've read it and I've seen lots of productions of it. And this just felt like a wall of dense nonsense, throughout the whole thing. I could not get connected to any of the characters. Was Kevin Kline in it?
He was. I actually liked Kevin Kline in this movie. I think he's somebody who's quite good at Shakespeare. He just never gets cast in good adaptations.
That's true. Yeah.
but he is really good at it, and I really enjoyed him in this movie. I thought it was all right, but the thing that made me sad was that it was supposed to be Branagh's farewell to Shakespeare, and I don't know if you remember, there's that final scene, which is basically the symbolic gesture of, you know, him closing the book on Shakespeare and everything. In his career, and it just seems to be going out with a whimper.
Mm-hmm. A shitty whimper. With just a little bit of sick dribbling out of the corner of his mouth.
Somewhere where the wind whispers, "You got me killed."
Wow. Anyway, who's next?
Well, since we're on the subject of Branagh and Shakespeare, I'll say that even though As You Like It isn't really an exceptional film, I don't think it's his worst Shakespeare adaptation. I think that goes to Love's Labour's Lost.
That was a nice segue, Clark.
What's that?
That was a nice segue.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Improved immeasurably by interrupting and pointing it out. It's the They Came From the North style. Hey, this is really going well. Let's just...
And for only $49.99 a month, I'm willing to provide segues for your podcast, too. So just
at least we didn't
look up my website.
We're blast processing and start singing Come Segue Away. Come Segue
This is a professional podcast.
Anyway. You're listening to The Amateur Hour.
Clark was talking about a Shakespearean adaptation or something, I think.
Yes, Love's Labour is Lost. It's awful. It's ambitious. I'll give it that. And most of Branagh's stuff is actually fairly ambitious. He rarely just sort of phones it in. But
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, it's a big musical, which incorporates lots of sort of American popular songs from, I think they're mostly from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, you know, Gershwin-y sort of stuff, and tries to weave those into the narrative, and it's just painful to watch. None of it works. I couldn't get interested in any of the characters. The acting is actually kind of bad, with the exception of maybe Nathan Lane, who I thought did a decent job in his part. But
Nathan Lane, the highlight of your movie.
Right. And that, yeah.
You know you have problems.
I mean, that kind of says it all. But
I wasn't going to bring it up.
It's the only Branagh film on his filmography to date that I just cannot imagine going back and watching again at any point. It was just so painful.
Mm-hmm. I never understood, I never entirely understood the appeal of taking Shakespeare and transplanting it to other eras.
I mean, you know? I'm okay with transplanting it to other eras, but trying to, like, force it into these, like, it's a genre, like, it's trying to make it a musical. It's,
well, they tried to make it like a 1930s musical.
Yeah, I mean, it is, yeah. It's, Shakespeare kind of knew what he was doing when he was writing his plays and, you know, actually setting them where they were set.
Well, like the whole, you know, Romeo and Juliet being set
and
in,
not
what,
having,
was it they, what was they called it, instead of Verona, it was like
Verona Beach,
you know?
I mean, even that, I mean, I can kind of get behind, but, like, putting musical numbers into it, just...
And this one feels sort of like the height of Branagh's overconfidence, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was actually his follow-up to Hamlet, which, you know, despite mixed opinions on it now, received a pretty good deal of critical acclaim.
And it got a number of Oscar nominations.
Yeah,
it did.
High regard.
So, I mean, what do you follow that with? You've got this big 4-hour... supposedly definitive version of Shakespeare's most popular play, and you're going to do Shakespeare again, so, you know, I guess he wanted to try and spice things up and figured he could do anything he set his mind to and said, sure, I'll make it a 30s musical.
Right, ambulance chaser.
But yeah, it's and it pretty much killed his career. I mean, it was such a poorly received movie. It flopped at the box office, got horrible reviews. He did not direct another movie for the big screen for 7 years until he did the remake of Sleuth, and that was a small, cheap little movie, certainly not on the level of grandeur of his other stuff. But
I do recall I was working in the video store when Sleuth came out. I mean, of course, it was never released in theater, and well, here anyway. And I remember there being a big deal about it being, you know, Kenneth Branagh's return to... And even we had our, you know, our demo reel that I used to hear for 11 hours a day. And whenever the trailer for Sleuth came out, you know, from acclaimed director Kenneth Branagh, you know, mm-hmm. Kenneth Branagh's return to Hollywood or something. Like, it had,
but it was
unfortunately, you know,
married to a lot of cynicism about it. It was like, oh, we're remaking a genuine, sort of classic that didn't have to be updated. And
but I remember sitting down, because that was when Michael Caine was in, wasn't it? Michael Caine was in?
Yeah.
Yeah, but while we're on that, my ugly is Sleuth.
Oh.
No.
Wah, wah. I mean, I liked it until the third act. And
That's fair.
That's where it goes completely off the rails, and it just ends up being ugly and mean and nihilistic and just... I mean, the original movie is fun. It's entertaining. To me, it feels like, you know, like all those comic books in the wake of, like, Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen. That's Sleuth. That's compared to the original, you know? It's like the dark...
When the girl with the dragon tattoo was immensely popular, so it had to be downtrodden and...
Yeah, it's like it's the dark, gritty version.
Harlan's Sleuth.
and
making it with more capes.
Another thing that really bothered me, it took something that was subtext in the original movie and made it very much text and obvious. And I'm like, seriously? You had to really point it in our face, you know?
This is where Gabe comes out in favor of traditional marriage.
No. No, this is where Gabe...
cake for those couples!
This is where Gabe comes out in the favor of subtlety. In movies.
You know what? Maybe I'm being terrible here now. Well, what else is new? But I had no idea that Sleuth was a remake until now.
Everything you need to know about Sleuth is in a screenshot I'm now holding on my cell phone. There, listeners.
And Sleuth is not only a remake, but I'm going to defend it a little bit and say I think it's a very interesting remake because it actually does something a lot of remakes don't do, which is taking the original material and trying to do something completely different with it. It's
kind of like
basically an inverted version of the original movie, because the original Sleuth is based on a play by this guy named Anthony Schaefer, and he loves these big long monologues and purple prose, and it's fun, but it's, you know, nearly 2.5 hours of people talking at each other in entertaining ways. And this one was written by the playwright Harold Pinter, and it's the exact opposite of that. It's terse, it's mean, it's to the point. This movie's like 80-something minutes where, you know, yes. So it shaves off nearly an hour. The original movie took place in this sort of fun house where there are all these crazy bits of memorabilia and clowns and all kinds of wacky things around this guy's house. And in this one, it's this ridiculously minimalist house where it's all glass and black and white and, you know, minimalist furniture and all this stuff. And I don't know, it's a very interesting sort of alternate take on that story.
I found it interesting, and I like some of the things that they did. Like, for example, in the original movie, and, you know, I'll spoil some stuff here, Michael Caine dresses up as a detective. Like, he puts on makeup, and you can tell it's Michael Caine because because of his voice. And then in the remake, Jude Law, he modifies his voice and everything, but his makeup isn't that good, and you can still tell it's Jude Law under there.
Mm-hmm.
That shows up the kind of version that they were doing, but in the end, I think it really just left a bad taste in my mouth. You know, like I found that the third act didn't have enough space to proceed, and just I don't know, it just felt like being cut short. You know, like I was missing something, and yeah, just the air of oppression in that movie, which is well done, but I think maybe because I saw it so soon after the original, I'm like, I had so much fun with that to have something dark and gritty with the same basic plot just didn't sit well with me.
I just realized that Jude Law also remade Alfie.
He did.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which was not that interesting.
Which is kind of a shame, because Jude Law can be a very interesting cat. You know, he can be a really damn.
I mean,
good
Dom
actor.
Hemingway looks fucking terrible, but at the same time,
yeah,
it's like clearly he's, you know, in the words of William Hurt, he's got some afterburners that haven't been fired.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think he's gotten better and better too now that he's gotten out of this sort of dashing leading man phase of his career,
Mr. Ripley kind of thing. He had going on.
Well, yeah. His hair is receding now, right?
Although even fairly early on, he had, you know, he had Road to Perdition, and he was pretty goddamn different in that movie, too. You know?
I mean, I think the problem is most of his critical acclaim came from playing what was essentially a vapid pretty boy in The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yeah.
And so they were like, well, he's really good, but this is the role he's really good in, which made people think that he should be in all of these really dull roles.
Yeah.
Like
Alfie.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, to finish, I don't think it's that bad of a movie. I just, like you guys said about that. Stephen John said about Hamlet, I just didn't like it.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's pretty good. you got to say, the guy has got to be doing something right when the worst movie you can pick on is Sleuth.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got to be doing... I was inclined to go Frankenstein as my ugly because the movie is just so heavily compromised, but, I mean, Hamlet in the end for me because it just bored me to tears, but... But yeah, I mean, you know, that said, like, there's nothing there that you can overtly pick on as being, like, absolutely wretchedly awful, you know?
No, exactly. Branagh at his worst is sort of misguided and overambitious.
And cheesy.
it can be cheesy, but he's a guy who's always trying things, which I respect a great deal.
And he's a very earnest filmmaker, too, which is another thing I appreciate about him.
I think, in all honesty with Brennan, I think he's earnest in everything he does. You know, I think even, you know, even something that is, you know, from what you call an A-list or acclaimed actor's perspective as something like the Harry Potter movies. I mean, even there with his Roy Lockhart, you know, he's giving it his all, you know? Even in something as commercial and base to someone who's, you know, quote-unquote mastered Shakespeare, as Harry Potter, the guy comes in and gives 110%, you know?
And I've honestly kind of missed him in the past decade or so. He hasn't really been on the big screen as much as I would like. I think he's a pretty good actor.
Yeah,
a lot of people seem to have this attitude towards him where they're like, oh, the over-actor Kenneth Branagh and this whole sort of thing when you read reviews. But I always enjoy seeing him.
Roles have been him directing himself, trying to emulate Olivier.
Mm-hmm.
Or not necessarily, I mean, I don't think in performance emulate Olivier, but I really think he genuinely wants to be Olivier. And so when he directs himself, he's
a
bit of
a worship on the go.
Right?
Yeah. I don't know. I think he's a great actor. I think he's a pretty imaginative director, too. And I mean, again, I go back to Shadow Recruit. He was a fantastic villain in that movie. He didn't have a whole lot to do because the movie isn't near so epic in scope as you'd be led to believe by the trailers. Mm-hmm. But as this, you know, somewhat intelligent, smart villain, he was damn effective. You know, he was really effective in that movie. And I mean, it's a simple role, but he knocks it out of the park, you know?
I think he's recently come to appreciate what can be done in sort of big popular cinema.
Yeah.
And I think he kind of thought of himself as sort of iconoclastic and, you know, nobody's doing Shakespeare. I'm going to do Shakespeare. I'm going to shake things up. And now it's kind of like, oh, I can tell interesting stories or at least very entertaining stories. And I don't have to always be reaching for the cheap seats.
I think it's great that Thor was such a success because it kind of put him back on the map a little bit. It gave him movies again, you know?
I'm really curious about what he's going to do with Cinderella too, because it does seem like if he's able to do what he wants with it, that's the sort of thing that could be right in his wheelhouse.
And it seems to have some kind of stunt casting, because Helena Bonham Carter plays the fairy godmother. I mean, that's weird, right?
It is. It kind of is. Yeah.
But I think one thing that distinguishes Branagh both as an actor and as a director is his energy, you know? He really always gives it his all, like Steve said. And his movies, even though they're not always work or whatever, they're always energetic. They always want to try to draw you in.
There's something that I sort of think of as... It's a performance that I think of as symbolic of Branagh's approach to work and what works really well. His role in the second Harry Potter movie is showy. But it is extremely well controlled and it's really funny. He's working with a hack director, basically.
Yeah, yeah. He's working with Chris Columbus.
It was Chris Columbus.
Yeah, yeah.
But it sort of shows that, you know, he has an energy and a flamboyance that can work beautifully. But it has to be very carefully controlled. And it's a really tough energy to harness.
And I think that's a lot of what Branagh's gift is that he knows that.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's his own best gauge. He knows when, you know, when too far is too far. He knows when to dial it back. He knows when to kind of, You know? Not so much as a director, but I think as an actor. As an actor, I think he does, you know?
I think as a director, he's... for somebody who's got that reach, like, I mean, I'm not... We were talking about earlier, I'm not going to knock someone who attempts to turn a Shakespearean play into a 1930s musical, right? Mm-hmm. But he's much more successful at it than someone like Baz Luhrmann.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
He's, oh, gosh.
You know, this...
I can't wait for the Baz Luhrmann episode. Steve, I don't have one. What's your bad, Steve? I don't have one.
You like
what's your ugly, Steve? How much time you got?
Strictly Ballroom is actually a good formulaic comedy.
Actually, you know what? I did really dig Australia. I'm sorry. I did. I forgot about that one.
But, no, this is
an epic?
Yeah.
With desert scenes? I'm there.
Does that surprise you, really?
Yeah, no, he's got that reach, but... Most of, like, more than 75% of the time, the guy's got the tools to back it up.
Yeah.
Right? Like I said, he, like, even something like Jack Ryan, I mean, he shoots the shit out of it. He really frames the scenes really well. And, I mean, the Dutch angles, I love them.
I mean, yeah, the guy might have failures, but they're noble failures.
Yeah.
And, I mean, even in a case like Frankenstein, where, like I said earlier, I mean, I find that movie to be horribly compromised. But I think that was something that was kind of taken away from him.
Yeah, that wasn't him so much. It was
kind of a conflict over what he wanted to deliver versus what the studio wanted on screen, you know?
Agreed.
I think overall, though, he's an effective director. I think he's a pretty effective... Yes. I mean, he doesn't necessarily have this... You know, you're sitting down watching a movie and you immediately... I look at Thor and I wouldn't say, oh, yeah, hell, I'm watching a Kenneth Branagh movie. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I wouldn't look at... Shadow Recruit and say, I'm watching a Kenneth Branagh movie.
This is the director of Hamlet here, so...
Yeah. You know, he doesn't have that signature style or that
but
signature tone.
I think he's one of those guys, like some of the better but less obvious directors like William Wyler.
Yeah.
I don't know immediately when a movie comes on, this is a William Wyler movie, but if I watch three William Wyler movies... I can see what he's doing and a consistent approach to filming and that he does, I mean, he's a fucking pro who knows how to shoot a story and does it in a specific way, but it's not a showy way.
Yeah.
I mean, Branagh's showy, but not...
He knows what serves the story. Yeah, you know, exactly. He knows what serves the story. He knows what to do and what not to do kind of thing.
And the fact that he's always doing different things.
And, I mean, he's had no interest whatsoever in developing franchises like Thor. Even before he knew whether it was going to be a hit or not, he basically said, I'm making this movie and that's it, and then I'm going to go do whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with Jack Ryan, you know, it's, I'll start your franchise for you, but then I'm going to go do this other thing.
Well, what better place to be, though, than at the beginning, right? You know, because
you
kind of write your ticket then, and, hey, if it is a great success... And like in the case of Thor, for example, you know, where Thor was a surprise success, everybody was expecting absolute shit, and the movie delivers, and then the sequel comes along, and people are kind of like, wait, we want Kenneth Branagh, you know, and...
Too bad, Lovelace, you had me.
like that's actually pretty...
We took you for granted.
That's actually pretty smart on his part, too, you know? Like, it's actually a pretty clever idea to kind of get in on the ground floor, establish yourself as a name that's associated with it, and even if it is, you know... I mean, in terms of the Marvel films, Kevin Feige controls them with an iron fist, you know? Like, nobody contradicts what Feige wants. This is why Edgar Wright is not doing Ant-Man, you know? But,
damn it.
You know, Branagh turned in, you know, what was mandated and walked away.
And I think he delivered a more interesting movie than, for example, what we're going to get from Scott Derrickson with Doctor Strange, which will be professional and it'll fit the Marvel brand and it'll be entertaining. Yeah. It'll be scary and it'll be funny, but it won't be like, it won't feel distinctive.
Yeah. And that's, I think, the biggest thing about Thor. When you put Thor in, you know, a swimming pool with Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Iron Man 3, Captain America, the Avengers and all of these, Thor is the most distinctive movie of the bunch. You know, it really does have a feel that's all its own.
I still couldn't see anything in that first part about them going after the Ice Giants. That was dark.
Yeah. Oh my God, man. I had it on Netflix there a few weeks ago before they took it off Canadian Netflix. few months ago now, not weeks, sorry. And my television's got a setting that I'm trying to figure out how to turn off that when there's so much black on the screen, now it dims the screen.
Mm.
And I saw flashes of blue face.
And I didn't have an issue with it.
I heard a voice call out, at least make it a challenge for me. A rainbow explosion, and then the movie started.
So the beginning of Thor is basically like the last 10 minutes of Ang Lee's Hulk, where it's just a murky something.
Didn't happen. We don't speak that name.
There are things I love about that movie.
Oh, the Ang Lee.
Yes.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Oh, man.
There's things I love about that movie, like how he fails so miserably in 2.5 hours that it goes full circle. It was amazing.
So, parting thoughts
there's
on...
a glorious half hour.
We just did 15 minutes of parting thoughts. Parting.
Yeah, well,
stop recording now!
Who's next? Who's picking next?
It's me, and next week we're going back. It's been a while since we did a big director, and I'd figure we would go big, and I chose Martin Scorsese.
Did you just say next week?
Yeah, I said next week.
It's going to be a week when he's right.
Yes.
I'd like it to
weeks be last longer in Canada, though, if I understand
podcast,
correctly.
You'll be listening to.
Weeks in Canada last 42 days.
Okay. That's what they taught me in school, but I
something to do with the number of time zones we have.
So yeah, so we'll probably do 2 episodes about Scorsese, because
early and later.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. The later period's gonna suck for me.
I feel like, but the 2 periods will be like everything up to Bringing Out the Dead, and then like Gangs of New York to now.
Yeah,
it kind of feels like terrible. The second episode.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. Or it's got to be pre DiCaprio.
Yeah,
pre and post DiCaprio.
I was thinking up to Goodfellas, and then from Cape Fear to today.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
I wish I could use that.
Okay, so Martin Scorsese next. That's something to look forward to. I guess that's it. All we got left to say now is what?
See you next Wednesday.
We are.